From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Michigan's juvenile lifers. Who gets a second chance? We look at why so many juvenile lifers in our state are not getting a shot at resentencing despite two landmark Supreme Court rulings.
Punishing kids does not have a deterrent effect because kids are not reading the newspapers about what happens to people. And even if you do, it's not going to happen to you.
A creative way of dealing with stormwater is being pioneered in Detroit.
There are going to be lots of holes in the ground in Detroit where demolitions are happening on blighted structures. What if those holes were filled with sand?
And John U. Bacon on the Lions in the playoffs.
We are still talking about the Lions, not about rebuilding or how do you re-scrap it. What do you do next year? They're actually in the hunt.
Those stories and more. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Two landmark Supreme Court rulings declared that mandatory life in prison without parole for a minor is a sentence that is cruel and unusual, except in the rarest of cases. And the court ruled those prisoners should be resentenced. But many prosecutors in Michigan are pushing to uphold the mandatory life sentences for most of the cases in their counties.
It applies to everyone. You can't continue to punish people with cruel and unusual punishment in the future just because they were convicted years ago.
Michigan's Juvenile Lifers, Who Gets a Second Chance, a week-long series of special reports, begins with a look at the history of mandatory life without parole sentencing for young offenders. That comes later in the hour. But first, this week marks the last few days of the 2015-2016 session of the state legislature, so it'll be curtains down on lame duck. Let's find out what's alive, what's dead, or extremely sleepy in these final few days of lame duck. Zach Gorchow of Gongwer News Service is back here with us again. In 2012's lame duck, Zach, we saw legislative Republicans push through right to work and the new emergency manager law, responding to voters rejecting the old law. This year, though, things fizzled out in their bid to go after pension benefits for teachers and municipal employees like police and fire. These are on the dead list. Why so?
It just was too much to, in the case of the municipal retiree stuff, too much too late to try to accomplish. A very complex piece of legislation, and it was just kind of thrown in there late and in the process provoked police officers and firefighters into a torrent of criticism, and that just killed it. There was no recovering from it. They'll take another crack at it next year. This has been something that's been worked on behind the scenes for a while, but they're really going to be starting over now. On the teacher pension changes, this would have closed the pension portion of the teacher retirement plan to new teachers. They ran into the same problem that this issue has run into before, which is the governor does not support that change. They're going to take a heck of a lot of criticism for doing it, and in the end, I think a lot of senators, Republican senators, said, why would we take all this heat for something that the governor's going to veto? I mean, we've seen before the governor tends to be pretty circumspect about saying he's going to sign something or veto something. And he didn't use the word veto, but he made it very clear he does not support that piece of legislation.
So we can expect these issues to be revived in 2017 because now the cards have been put out on the table. And as you say, the municipal employee issues have been quietly worked on, but it's out there now.
Oh, yeah. Both issues will be back, no question.
What else has withered on the vine during this lame duck session?
Well, there was a two significant, relatively late introduced economic development incentives. One of which would have changed the income tax rules for businesses that hired large numbers of new employees. It would have allowed them essentially to keep the income tax withholdings from those employees' paychecks as a form of tax incentive instead of sending that money off to the Michigan Department of Treasury like everyone else. That passed the Senate super fast. It kind of came out of nowhere, passes the Senate, and the House just immediately said, no, we're not going to do that. Felt too much like going back to the old tax credit system of the past. The Snyder administration would say, no, that's not the case. But it ran into a brick wall in the House. The other tax incentive legislation deals with brownfields. This is the legislation that Dan Gilbert and other economic development organizations have been pushing for, essentially would allow a handful of large so-called transformational projects on brownfields to reap a tax credit. That passed the Senate. The governor's office was kind of iffy on that one. They never really said whether they were for it or against it. Then the House has said they will not support it. Now, the House Republicans have said they will not support it. Now, the supporters of this say that they are still trying. They are still trying to convince Kevin Cotter, the Speaker of the House, to pursue this, but it doesn't look good for it.
Well, you know, you got to wonder, this is more than just Dan Gilbert. There are developers all over this state lobbying for this. They say this could help get needed projects off the ground in places like Flint.
Yeah, Saginaw is a big component of this. And while Dan Gilbert is clearly the big name and most recognizable face, the supporters of this have gone to great lengths to show, hey, look, we've got people all over the state who would be interested in getting in on one of these projects. There would be a limit of 5 for the whole state and a cap of $50 million on the overall tax incentive. So you may not see all, you know, a full 5 at any given point, but it would be open to the full state.
And so this one would come under what you call extremely sleepy?
Yes, yes. As Fletch said in the movie, it was dead or extremely sleepy, yes.
How about that auto insurance legislation that passed the Senate? What would it do and how's it looking in the House?
Okay, so you got to go, well, this passed the Senate a long time ago. The specifics of the legislation, the main crux of it is to deal with the cost of catastrophic medical care. Mm-hmm. This has been a big issue for a long time with the insurance industry, that they want some limits on how much that is paid out to cover catastrophic medical injuries, or allowing people to choose to pay more to have the unlimited benefits that there are now. It's taken a million different forms, whether it's a hard cap or a choice and so forth. And it just does not have the votes in the House. I mean, I'm not totally ignoring it because it is sitting there in the House. It's eligible to be acted upon. But all of those who are involved with it say that it just doesn't seem to be anything that's happening with it. There's just too many House Republicans and the full caucus of House Democrats who have opposed doing anything that really curbs in any way the unlimited medical benefits for catastrophic injuries that is in place now.
Zach, there's a massive package of bills aimed at reforming our criminal justice system. Without going too much into all of them, what's the major sticking point on whether these move forward?
Well, the big issue as far as the one that's attracted the most attention is the so-called presumptive parole legislation that says, say you're sentenced to 20 to 30 years in prison, you reach that 20 years, as long as the Michigan Department of Corrections judges that you're likely to succeed upon release, that you will be released. You cannot be kept in until 30, you know, you reach that 30 years. But it has run into a lot of problems, sort of law and order message from Republicans. The Attorney General, Bill Schuette, doesn't like it. Mm. One of the big problems it has now is even though it's passed the House, the main proponent of that piece of legislation has left the House and is now the supervisor of Plymouth Township. So it's really number one legislative advocate is not there anymore. We're all kind of waiting to see what will happen. And I should note the person who replaced that individual as the chair of the Criminal Justice Committee in the House voted against the legislation when it passed the House. So it doesn't look great for it. And it wouldn't shock me if all of those bills just kind of withered because there's just no agreement on moving the respective chambers' legislation. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but it wouldn't surprise me.
Zach, what bills, what are the big bills you'd put under the alive and kicking headline?
Oh, boy. Well, I think you definitely have to look at the voter ID legislation. Mm-hmm. Has got to be looked at as something that's lurking out there. It's gotten a lot of attention and deservedly so. This is the bill that would say basically you have to show an identification, photo identification, when you vote. And if you can't, then you have to come back within 10 days for your vote to count unless you can really demonstrate that you are indigent and can't afford that form of ID. So that would really tighten up the voter identification requirement.
And that's been pushed by Representative Lyons of Alto. And where is that standing then?
That's sitting in the Senate. And okay. One of the things that's interesting is the chair of the House Elections Committee, you just mentioned her name, Representative Lisa Lyons, mm-hmm. and the chair of the Senate Elections Committee, Senator Dave Robertson, have really not seen eye to eye on a lot of elections issues this year. And they're sort of staring eyeball to eyeball. And again, this is one where it's possible nothing will happen. It's possible there could be an agreement in all of these issues that are lurking out there. This involves the codification of Citizens United and other elections issues that are lurking. You have the legislation that would ban the use of seclusion and restraint practices in schools. That made it out of the House after a long year's worth of work. Now the Senate has to decide if they can digest this legislation and pass it in 3 days. The lieutenant governor is pushing very heavily on it. You've got legislation that's a priority of the senator from Flint, would create a recovery authority and would make Flint eligible for the Promise Zone that allows helping paying students tuition if they're from the city, college tuition. Those are sitting in the House. Don't know what's going to happen there. So there's a long list of things that's sitting out there.
Any chance of a real out-of-left-field surprise coming down the pike in these final few days of lame
duck? Oh, yeah. There always is. You know, any bill that's sitting has passed one House or the other, if it's a multi-section bill, can be amended essentially to do anything within that particular law. So it could go from being something that seems very narrowly tailored to something entirely different. We saw that on a big elections issue at the end of last year. So that's always something to watch for. And you really have to be prepared for anything and everything.
And, of course, if voters are not happy with what did or didn't come out during lame duck, a whole bunch of those lawmakers won't be around in the new year to deal with the fallout.
Yeah, more than 40 members of the House will not be back.
Zach Gorchow, Gongwer News Service. Always great talking with you, Zach. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Time for our weekly check-in with Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. And John, we've got good news and perhaps some worrisome news for the Lions. That nice 20-17 win over the Bears was their fifth straight win and another come-from-behind win. Who or what do you think is working best for Detroit?
Well, I'm going to repeat myself here, but you have to start with Matt Stafford, about whom I've been notably unimpressed for 7 years, basically a lot of hype and no delivery for 7 years. First-round draft pick, was not very tough mentally or physically, frankly. And this year he's been incredibly tough mentally and physically and on point. He has been phenomenal. He might be an MVP candidate now, which I cannot believe I'm telling you.
And you were also, a few weeks ago, you really went out of your way to praise General Manager Bob Quinn, doing good things.
And you've probably not heard of his name. You're probably not going to. He's behind the scenes. He's very quiet about it. But when you have 55 players to play around with, 54 players in the NFL, you got to do a lot of moves back and forth. It's half as many players as the college team has. So guys get injured. You're always shuffling. He's doing it very quietly. He's making a lot of great decisions. One of them, surprisingly, Calvin Johnson leaving the team, the best wide receiver arguably in the NFL, certainly one of them.
Yeah.
And Stafford has been so much better without him.
Isn't that interesting?
Amazing.
The house of cards did not collapse. It's interesting to note this was Stafford's eighth fourth quarter comeback this season, so it is the most now in a single season, I think, since 1950. Why so much come from behind?
One thing is the way the NFL is set up, which we've talked about. The games are designed to boil down to 3 or 4 plays. The NFL wants all the games to be close, so you keep watching. So the games come down to 3 or 4 plays. So that's part of the deal. Second thing is their defense started out being pretty mediocre. Now it's gotten fairly decent, actually. I can't believe I'm saying that either, Cynthia. But the third thing is, I mean, this team wakes up apparently in the second half. And it's kind of like procrastinating on a term paper. Once you know you can do it, you keep on procrastinating more and more and more. This has been my experience as a writer. I can tell you that. This team procrastinates. They know that in the fourth quarter they got the guy. And Stafford is playing with as much confidence, skill, and toughness as I've seen any Lions quarterback play with ever.
And speaking of being tough, he was wearing that white glove for much of the game, not in tribute to Michael Jackson, as we should note, but he's got a dislocated finger and torn ligaments in his right hand, his throwing hand. But it happened in the first quarter, and he stayed put.
I've not done that to myself. I've seen friends of mine playing hockey have that done to them. It is incredibly painful. By all accounts, any one of us would be driving to the ER right away. This guy finished the game, and he's going to play next week too, it sounds like. So
that's what I wondered. How worried should fans be as they think of that throwing hand being impaired?
Here's the good news. They're 9-4 right now. They're almost in the playoffs right now as it is. And that being the case, they can probably give the guy 2 or 3 weeks off at the end to heal. But it is serious.
Well, when you think about 3 more games to go at the Giants, at the Cowboys, and hosting the Packers. So the Lions have the toughest remaining schedule. What do you think their chances are? Can we feel like it's going to happen?
They need one more win, frankly. Mm-hmm. That's about it. Now, the Cowboys is the real test because that's your main competition in the NFC to get to the Super Bowl. If you can't beat them, you're not going to get there.
But they lost to the Giants yesterday.
They did lose to the Giants yesterday, and they're playing the Giants next, by the
way.
So that's the good news and bad news. This is the big boy finish to the schedule. You're going to find out where they stand. And the Packers are fighting for their lives, of course, so if they have a life left. So it's interesting. By the way, this is December. We are still talking about the Lions, not about rebuilding or how do you re-scrap it? What do you do next year? They're actually in the hunt.
So we should all enjoy this as it's happening.
Don't take it for granted, people.
Okay, let's go over to college football. I want to start with Eastern. Here they are, off to getting ready to play Old Dominion in the Bahamas Bowl December 23rd, only their second bowl game ever. And, boy, talk about the team that only won one game last season, so never say die.
You have to say Jim Creighton, the coach of EMU, has been all that one of the best, in my opinion, out there. They're 6-6, but, man, they were 1-whatever last year. Sadly, now, here's where I become Debbie Downer.
Okay.
That I said earlier, of course, on your show on NPR, that, look, they've got no fans. They've got no wins. They're spending too much money on this program. Now you are winning. You still don't have very many fans, and you still are spending a ton of money. So this, I hate to say it, might be the acid test for why you get rid of football at Eastern Michigan. Even winning does not solve the problem.
All right. We'll watch for that. But they certainly did flip things around.
They did, and hats off to Creighton. That's one of the best coaching jobs I've seen.
And speaking of great coaching jobs, Western's P.J. Fleck getting all kinds of national attention for taking the Broncos through this 13-0 season, winning the MAC championship, onto the Cotton Bowl. And we've talked about the fact you don't think he's along for Kalamazoo, but it does seem the D1 openings kind of, they're being filled and not by him.
That's exactly right. And conventional wisdom often fails. It's failing in this case, and I'm part of that failure. I thought for sure he'd be going somewhere, Texas, a school like this, Oregon, the big boy programs. I've said that twice today. I don't know why.
Is it that could they be watching and going, well, let's see what you do next year. Let's see if this is something that
continues? No, I think they, in Oregon's case, in Texas's case, they've already got their guy lined up. And so that's what happened there. Nonetheless, I think Fleck has not put himself out there that much and saying, I'm available. And for him to stick around Western, I have to tell you, it's a fairly sizable career risk because you're not going 13-0 next year, not with all these seniors leaving. If they're, 7-5, was it a fluke? And now can you leave at all if you want to leave? So he is investing heavily, I think, in Western as they are in him.
Hat tip to the Chips. Central Michigan goes to the Miami Beach Bowl against Tulsa December 19th. Of course, we know Michigan faces Florida State in the Orange Bowl on December 30th, although no college football championship action for the Wolverines. But you stop and you think this would have been the first time in history that Michigan, MSU, CMU, Western, and Central would have qualified for bowl games, but there's Sparty sitting on the sidelines.
If you had to bet which team out of that batch would not have made it, State would have been probably the least likely. They were 36-5 the last 3 years, one of the two or three best teams in college football, and now they're not even close.
Well, I think we can all bet that Coach D'Antonio is hard at work making sure that doesn't happen next year.
He is not spending his time making s'mores.
Michigan Radio's sports commentator, John Eubagen. As always, thanks, John.
Thank you.
Creation.
Vision.
The next idea.
What they have helped us do is to really think in a totally different way about how to deliver and create something new.
Stormwater runoff is one of the major environmental issues facing communities all across the country. It's the rainfall or the snowmelt that runs off the ground, the paved surfaces like parking lots and roads, and usually right into streams, lakes, surface water. So it's a leading cause of water pollution. Researchers from the University of Michigan have come up with a pretty creative way to help manage stormwater and at the same time tackle blight in Detroit neighborhoods. Their solution, bioretention gardens created in old basements. Here with us is Joan Nassauer, who's a professor with the School of Natural Resources at U of M. Joan, welcome to The Next Idea.
Thank you.
How has stormwater traditionally been controlled in cities?
From the beginning of the 20th century and even in the 19th century, the idea with stormwater was to get it off the surface and underground as quickly as possible. And we did that essentially in pipes. And we call all those pipes that move water from the streets and underground and eventually to streams or lakes, we call that gray infrastructure.
And that is not to be confused with the water systems where water is treated. This just goes, these storm drains just go right out into and drain into water.
Well, actually, it's complicated. In many cities, including Detroit, the sanitary sewers are combined with the storm system, so that the storm water does not go directly into receiving waters. It goes through the water treatment plant. But therein lies one of the big challenges. The water treatment plants of our great American cities generally have not been built to treat the full capacity of big pushes of water, stormwater that come through the system during a spring melt or during a very big storm. And this problem that the treatment systems really can't treat all the sanitary sewage along with all the stormwater in a big storm is even more of a problem as we live with climate change, because part of climate change is big storms are getting bigger.
And I'm thinking, just without any effort at all, of news video of the flooded freeways and people that have completely destroyed basements because the water has backed up. And as you say, this is becoming more and more frequent.
Yes.
So how do these bioretention gardens work? You're using the basements of torn down houses for this?
So the idea with bioretention gardens is to keep stormwater close to where it falls. In the first project I ever did like this, back in Minnesota in the mid-90s, the civil engineer I worked with had a great way of describing it. He said we were just moving puddles. We're taking puddles and we're putting them underground. And the great thing about that is that that protects the combined sanitary and stormwater system from having too much water in it during big storms. So you keep the stormwater close to the surface. That keeps the sanitary and stormwater combined system running the way you want it to. This worked especially well back in the first project I did in Minnesota, where the area where we were working had very sandy soils. It's easy for water to infiltrate, get below ground, run through sand. It's more of a challenge in Detroit because Detroit has clayey soils, and if you pour water on clay, it generally runs right off. Yet bioretention needs to be part of the solution in Detroit. As we thought about this challenge, we thought, aha, there are going to be lots of holes in the ground in Detroit where demolitions are happening on blighted structures. What if those holes were filled with sand? And so that would allow the surface stormwater to be held in a very porous area and kind of substitute for the fact that Detroit soils are not sandy. And that's really the gist of the bioretention concept.
And then as an extra bonus, you're able to plant gardens and beautify what had been a hole.
That's right. And to me, this is really an essential part of thinking about green infrastructure to complement gray infrastructure in our cities. As I said, green infrastructure and bioretention gardens are meant to keep water close to where it falls. That means we're keeping stormwater in neighborhoods, and often those are more visible locations than those pipes underground. So why not make those visible locations that need to be maintained in order to keep the stormwater flowing, why not make them attractive, places that people can really enjoy passing by, living nearby in their neighborhood? That's the approach I've used in designing green infrastructure. Since I did that work in Minnesota 20 years ago, we've used that approach in Chicago. We've suggested solutions like this for Flint and Saginaw. And now, with the collaboration of the Detroit Water and Sewer Department and our research support from the Erb Family Foundation and the U of M Water Center, we've been able to get them built here in Detroit, and we're measuring how well they actually work.
How many have you built so far?
Four.
And what's the plan? What are you looking at to expand this?
Well, the construction and technical engineering of all of this work was done by DWSD and their engineering contractor, Tetra Tech. They're moving forward with bioretention as central to their green infrastructure approach throughout Detroit. By 2029, DWSD will invest $50 million in green infrastructure just on the west side of Detroit in the Upper Rouge Basin. So they're finding that this approach works, and they're moving forward with using it.
And I guess I'm wondering, as you say, you've offered this idea elsewhere. Has it been taken up? Are people watching what you're doing in Detroit and then maybe moving forward?
Yes, actually, the work we built in Minnesota in the mid-90s immediately became a kind of model that was adopted throughout the Twin Cities. That work has been emulated widely elsewhere. What's different about that work from what we've been able to do in Detroit is, well, really two things. As I said, the sandy soils in Minnesota made it all quite a bit easier to implement. But on the other hand, the parts of Minnesota, the Twin Cities where I worked, did not have a lot of vacant property. So the fact that Detroit has this vacant property now, it's difficult for people to live with blight, but it's also this enormous opportunity to rethink the way open spaces are integrated into neighborhoods, to rethink the way the dollars that DWSD will spend on managing stormwater can have all of these other benefits for citizens as well. So working in clay soils on demolition sites and working in neighborhoods that have an abundance of vacant property are two ways that the work in Detroit is really entirely new, and we're learning a lot by our social science research, for example, about how much this really is benefiting the residents who live nearby those first four bioretention gardens.
What do you hear from residents?
Well, we've done two things. We've worked very closely with the Warrendale Community Organization. All four of these first gardens are in the Warrendale neighborhood. And we've worked closely with the Côte des Rouges Community Action Alliance. So all along, we've taken our cues from them about how best to communicate with the people who live in the neighborhoods and especially near our garden sites. But also, we have interviewed every household or surveyed every household within 800 feet of the garden sites. So we've got some really good quantitative data. And these data show us that the people who live near the sites anticipate that the gardens will increase their property values, that they'll feel much safer in their neighborhoods, that they'll get out walking more, and that essentially their neighborhoods will just be more attractive places to live. And those are all data that we've analyzed using statistical techniques and with a very good survey. We're going to go back now that the gardens have been in place about a year and survey those households again next year to see what they think now.
I'm just curious, Joan, what have you found in terms of maintaining the gardens? How much work goes into that?
So one of the really great things, I think, about the approach, the multifunctional approach that we take in designing green infrastructure is that these gardens are essential to the stormwater functions that DWSD manages. That means that DWSD maintains these gardens. The gardens benefit from what nearby residents notice that needs to be done. It's always great if a nearby resident sees a weed and pulls it. I've been out there visiting the sites myself, seen some weeds that needed to be pulled and found myself standing next to a neighbor who also was pulling weeds. But essentially, the garden, the commitment to maintaining the gardens, to mowing them, to keeping them watered, is DWSD's commitment. And that's just a beautiful example of multifunctionalism. DWSD needs to maintain these gardens. People living nearby benefit.
Absolutely a great example, as you say, multifunctionalism. And you'll find Joan Nassar's essay on the Next Idea page. Just go to michiganradio.org. Joan is a professor in the School of Natural Resources at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us on the Next Idea. It's really exciting.
Cynthia, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Coming up, Michigan's juvenile lifers. Who gets a second chance? After the break, we kick off our week-long series of special reports looking at juvenile lifers in Michigan and the efforts to resentence many of them. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The United States Supreme Court has been crystal clear. Mandatory sentences of life without any chance of parole for juveniles is cruel and unusual punishment. These rulings have meant that more than 360 of these so-called juvenile lifers here in Michigan, which has the second highest total in the nation, are eligible for resentencing and possibly a second chance. Michigan has come under national scrutiny, however, for what critics from the ACLU to the New York Times editorial board argue is a failure by many of Michigan's prosecutors to comply with the Supreme Court. The prosecutors we spoke to, of course, disagree. All week long, Michigan Radio is looking at the state's juvenile lifers. This is a complex issue with life and death stakes, murders and victims, justice and fairness, and lots of legal maneuvering. Overall, it's a conversation about how we as a society should treat the most troubled children among us while also keeping in mind victims' rights. These aren't easy questions. We begin with some relevant history and context from Michigan Radio's Rick Pluta, who reports many of these prisoners were convicted of murder and locked up in the 80s and 90s during the tough-on-crime era.
These days, Tony Tague is focused on menus and dishing out pizza and pasta at his Italian restaurant in Spring Lake, a resort town tucked between a small chain of lakes in West Michigan. 30 years ago, life was different. Tague was the Democratic prosecutor in neighboring Muskegon County and grappling with a crack cocaine crime wave that swept the Interstate 96 corridor from Detroit to Muskegon.
We saw a lot of guns on the street. We saw a lot of territorial fights between particularly in Muskegon, Detroit drug dealers coming in and trying to take over the drug trade, which ended up resulting in a lot of turf battles, a lot of shootings.
Tague says juvenile crime became a growing problem, largely because the drug trade adopted a business model that relied on giving kids guns and using them as soldiers and couriers.
Everyone knew that if you were juvenile, even if you were charged with a life felony, chances are you'd do a couple years in the juvenile system and you would be released at the latest on your 21st birthday.
Public frustration grew as the murder rate spiraled, and it wasn't just Muskegon. The same thing was occurring across the state of Michigan and across the country, says Frank Vandervoort with the University of Michigan Juvenile Justice Law Clinic.
There was this notion of super predators, right? This idea that we had this whole generation of children who lacked a conscience, who were basically antisocial, and who had access to guns, and they were behaving like adults, they were committing adult-level crimes, and so therefore they should be receiving adult-level penalties and punishments.
Vandervoort says the focus shifted from trying to rehabilitate juveniles who committed crimes to punishing them. And this thinking was bipartisan. President Bill Clinton, a Democrat, called for a federal crime bill, and states like Michigan joined in. Here's Republican Governor John Engler addressing the Michigan legislature in January of 1996.
Our policy is to do everything possible to help youth succeed. But if they break the law, they need to know with certainty there will be consequences.
There was just this wave of tough on crime, lock them all up, throw away the key.
John Truscott was Engler's press secretary at the time.
No sympathy at all for any of the cultural things that they were going through, neighborhoods, broken homes. And I think at the time we thought if we can't educate them properly and get kids on the right path, then they might be lost. So we need to protect people, and that means locking them up.
Michigan adopted some of the toughest juvenile justice policies in the country, including adult time for adult crimes, especially first-degree murder. And Frank Vandervoort says that required mandatory life without parole.
And so you saw more kids going to prison for longer periods of time, and more of them being sent to prison for life without parole.
And in Michigan, first-degree murder charges can be lodged against anyone connected with a murder or the crime that led to a murder. So accomplices, getaway drivers, gang members, people who never directly took a life were charged with first-degree murder. It's one of the nation's most sweeping murder laws, and critics like attorney Deborah LaBelle say using it against juveniles just went too far.
Michigan was one of the few states who reached out and automatically charged 14-year-olds as low as 14. With a mandatory life without parole sentence.
Groups like the American Civil Liberties Union lobbied the legislature to rein in some of the harsher aspects of the law. Studies were launched on teenage brain development, and there was litigation originating in Michigan and other states. In 2005, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down Missouri's death sentence for people younger than 18. But Deborah LaBelle says juvenile life without parole is also a death sentence.
The jury has no choice. The judge has no choice. If you aid and abet or you're involved in an enterprise that is illegal and someone gets killed by someone else, you all get mandatory life in prison till you die.
6 years ago, LaBelle filed a federal lawsuit on behalf of hundreds of juvenile lifers in Michigan, seeking to give them a chance at parole. She says she felt she couldn't wait any longer because the state's first juvenile lifers started dying in prison.
Children who had been in prison since they were 14 and 15 years old got so old that they just started dying in the prison without any opportunity for release.
Her cause won a big victory in 2012. That's when the U.S. Supreme Court struck down mandatory life without parole for juveniles as cruel and unusual punishment, and said the punishment should only be applied in the rarest of cases. Michigan was among the states that tried to keep that decision from applying to juvenile lifers who were already serving the sentence.
I'm a man of faith, and I believe in forgiveness. But I also firmly understand that there are consequences to bad or evil decisions.
Attorney General Bill Schuette argued releasing them would break faith with and be needlessly cruel to the surviving family members of murder victims.
We need to make sure that in this discussion of teenage murders, we don't ignore or dismiss in a casual fashion the voices of victims.
But once again, the Supreme Court said automatic life without parole is cruel and unusual punishment, and it applies retroactively and in future cases. That means those juvenile lifers already serving deserved new sentences or parole hearings. Tony Tague, the former Muskegon County prosecutor, says taking another look at what Michigan did 30 years ago to deal with juvenile crime is probably worthwhile.
As I look back, perhaps reforms went a little too far, but on the other hand, at the time, as prosecutors, we needed tools to send a stronger message that juveniles involved in serious crime would be treated seriously.
Deborah LaBelle says many Michigan prosecutors are still not accepting the spirit or the letter of the decision that automatic life without parole violates the Constitution, and they're using every means they can to keep most of Michigan's 363 juvenile lifers from ever having a chance at freedom. And she says prosecutors still seek life without parole for new juvenile defendants in too many cases. Her solution? She has asked a federal judge to rule that no one charged as a juvenile can be sentenced to life without parole, and that no teenager is forever irredeemable in the eyes of the law. I'm Rick Pluta.
Let's talk more now with attorney Deborah LaBelle, based in Ann Arbor, where she directs the Juvenile Life Without Parole Initiative with the ACLU. She says Michigan prosecutors are ignoring the Supreme Court. Deb LaBelle, welcome.
Thank you.
In essence, the Supreme Court ruled juveniles who've been convicted of these very serious crimes that nearly always involve a homicide are different from adults. Briefly take us to these decisions and explain how is that? How did the court spell that out?
Well, this decision of the court followed three other decisions of the United States Supreme Court, which said that children are simply different from adults when they commit crimes. They're less culpable, and there are several reasons for that. Their brain is not as developed, and so that the whole things that we know as parents, that impulse control is not there, they don't anticipate consequences in the same way, they're subject to peer pressure, and generally they get into situations where if an adult were in, they might be able to extricate themselves, but children don't have those resources. Second, the court said many of these children are raised in circumstances and communities in which as a 15, 16-year-old, you can't just get in a car, drive away, and get a job somewhere else. You are stuck there. And therefore, the environment, both your home environment, whether it's a dysfunctional family or sometimes the poverty of your community, can impact your options and your choices. And third, the court said, these kids don't know how to negotiate the criminal justice system. They're children. And so they don't take pleas, they don't operate, they don't have resources to hire counsel like adults. And so they get the worst of the worst kind of representation. the most impoverished, whatever assigned counsel comes in, and they don't know how to help, and they often don't have information to give up. So the court said, taking all of these things together, we must treat children differently. And the most crucial point, the court said, is that children are uniquely capable of rehabilitation, uniquely. And so who they are now at 14, 15, 16, 17 is not who they will be as an adult when they grow up.
Put Michigan in context, Deb, with the rest of the country for us. Michigan has the second highest number of prisoners who were sentenced to life without parole as juveniles. And as we just heard Rick Pluta touch on this in his piece, and I'm looking for your view, why is the state an outlier in this area?
Well, Michigan has been particularly resistant to this for many, many years. First, Michigan set forth in the 1990s some of the harshest packages of laws that punish particularly youth. And at that time, they were talking about urban youth. I mean, I think the racial component of this can't be ignored. They were talking about thugs and gangs and that we had to punish them harshly because they were super predators, directly opposite to what our court has said. In fact, as we know, that punishing kids does not have a deterrent effect because kids are not reading the newspapers about what happens to people. And even if you do, it's not going to happen to you. And it doesn't serve a purpose to fail our children and then punish them with vengeance. What serves a purpose is to get children to be rehabilitated so that they can come back as an adult and contribute. But Michigan allowed punishment of life without parole, in fact, mandated punishment of life without parole for all first-degree homicide cases. So unlike in most states where you have different degrees and this is only a punishment for someone who commits a homicide, in Michigan, you can be in the car, you can be aiding and abetting, you can commit a robbery and an adult co-defendant commits a homicide, it doesn't matter. The punishment is exactly the same, and neither judge nor jury had a choice in that punishment. It was mandatory.
Or prosecutors.
Well, prosecutors on the front end would have a choice.
Yeah, take us to before the Supreme Court decisions. What discretions would the prosecutors have?
So at that time, any child in Michigan of any age, astonishingly, can be charged as an adult. And that's very unique in this country.
We saw Nathaniel Abraham at age 11 charged.
Exactly. And we have Charles Lewis Jr., who they tried to do it a few years ago when he was 12. But 14, 15, 16-year-olds, a prosecutor could decide to charge those in the juvenile system. Many of them did not because of, I think, public pressure or perceptions about being tough. But many children were, and we did a report on that that showed sort of the racial divide of who goes automatically to adult court and which kids are just having a bad moment and go through the juvenile system.
And you found what?
We found that there's a definite racial bias.
Just last month, Deb, you filed a lawsuit in federal court regarding Michigan's response to the Supreme Court rulings in Miller and Montgomery requiring all juveniles sentenced to life without parole to be resentenced. What's your argument here?
We actually filed the initial suit in 2010 before even the Supreme Court came down and said that life without parole mandatorily for youth was cruel and unusual punishment. When we saw what was happening in Michigan, the court said it had to only be the rare youth that commits a homicide offense, the rare one, the uncommon one, in which the crime evidenced irreparable corruption. And in Montgomery, the court said the child was impossible to be rehabilitated. Impossible. And then just in the last month, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected a few cases from Arizona and said, you gave four people life without parole. And Justice Sotomayor said, we said the very rarest. Listen, now we're rare. Now we're very rare. We're uncommon. So we're talking about a unique child that everyone has given up hope on, that there is no possibility of rehabilitation, and nothing that they have done shows any ability to rehabilitate themselves. Come back to Michigan now, and the prosecutors in some counties filed for every single youth in their county. There were youths who didn't even commit a homicide that they're now asking the court to say, that's the rare one. That's the irreparable one. That's the uncommon one. I know they didn't commit homicide, and I know that they've been completely rehabilitated because wardens and corrections officers have been writing letters saying, release this person. They were rehabilitated a long time ago. They've grown up. They're still asking for life without parole. They're asking for life without parole for people that they themselves offered plea bargains for. But the youth were too youthful to understand the consequences of rejecting that. So we said that it's not working in Michigan. And in fact, of the youth that have been resentenced, over half of them, the courts have issued life without parole sentences for. And it's partly because the Michigan statute is so problematic. It says courts can use aggravating factors, and it doesn't spell them out. So courts have said, well, and prosecutors and courts are saying, being 17 and a half is an aggravating factor, life without parole. Having a mental disability is an aggravating factor because you probably won't do so well on the outside, life without parole. Having a child out of wedlock before you went in prison is an aggravating factor. So the statute allows this whole unprincipled, arbitrary review. And Michigan has been resistant from the very beginning on this, and the resistance is continuing. So we've said to the court, there are now 39 states in this country that have abolished life without parole for juveniles or have not issued this sentence since the Miller Supreme Court decision. Enough. It's cruel. It's unusual. And the way it's being applied in Michigan shows that it should be categorically abolished.
Why do you believe prosecutors aren't stepping up to the challenge laid down by the U.S. Supreme Court?
Oh, I wouldn't want to put them all in one box. Mm-hmm. I think that there are some who just say the resources are too much and we're going to put it over here and we're going to say life without parole because we can now delay any of those hearings. I think that there are those who resisted the issue that children are different and continue to resist it. I think that there are those who tried these cases and stuck in their mind is a crime that happened, and therefore this is a just punishment, and they don't want to face the fact that those people have changed. So I think there are a bunch of different reasons, none of which do I believe are lawful or serve the public well.
Ann Arbor attorney Deborah LaBelle directs the Juvenile Life Without Parole Initiative with the ACLU. Later this week, we check back in with LaBelle regarding Michigan's mandatory life without parole sentence for young offenders. Tomorrow on Stateside, we'll get a prosecutor's perspective.
You know, there's no book you can pull off the shelf that will say, okay, Terry Morris should be given another chance, or Nathan Bell should be given another chance, or the young man who cut off his stepfather's head should be given another chance. These are difficult decisions that we had to make, and I think we did it properly in light of Miller and Montgomery.
You can follow our week-long series looking at Michigan's juvenile lifers and check out a breakdown of the numbers. Just go online to michiganradio.org.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.